Mission Gesundheit. Am Puls des medizinischen Fortschritts mit Dr. Hadi Saleh.
Herzlich willkommen zur 27. Folge Mission Gesundheit. Ich bin Dr. Hadi Saleh. Wem von euch sagt der Halo-Effekt etwas? Das ist ein psychologisches Phänomen, bei dem unsere Wahrnehmung einer Person durch eine einzelne positive Eigenschaft beeinflusst wird, die sie besitzt. Diese positive Eigenschaft strahlt sozusagen wie ein Heiligenschein, im Englischen Halo, auf andere Aspekte ihres Charakters oder ihrer Leistung aus. Dadurch können wir die Handlung dieser Person dann möglicherweise nicht mehr objektiv bewerten. Dies wird auch Bias oder Voreingenommenheit genannt. Ein klassisches Beispiel ist, wenn jemand äußerlich attraktiv wahrgenommen wird. Aufgrund dieser Attraktivität neigen Menschen dazu, Annahmen über andere Eigenschaften dieser Person zu treffen, wie Intelligenz, Freundlichkeit oder Kompetenz, ohne direkte Beweise für diese Eigenschaft zu haben. Der Halo-Effekt kann auch in anderen Bereichen auftreten, wie zum Beispiel in der Arbeitswelt, wenn eine Person aufgrund einer herausragenden Fähigkeit oder Leistung als insgesamt talentiert oder kompetent wahrgenommen wird, ohne dass andere Aspekte ihrer Leistung objektiv bewertet wurden. Es ist wichtig, sich des Halo-Effekts bewusst zu sein, da er unsere Urteile und Entscheidungen beeinflussen kann, indem er uns dazu verleitet, Annahmen über Menschen oder Dinge zu treffen, basierend auf nur einer einzelnen positiven oder negativen Eigenschaft. Das Gegenteil des Halo-Effekts wird oft als Horn-Effekt bezeichnet. Beim Horn-Effekt wird unsere Wahrnehmung einer Person durch eine einzige Eigenschaft beeinflusst, in diesem Fall aber durch eine negative. Ähnlich wie beim Halo-Effekt kann diese negative Eigenschaft wie ein Teufelshorn wirken und unsere Wahrnehmung anderer Aspekte des Charakters oder der Leistung der betreffenden Person trüben. Die eben vorgestellten Mechanismen können dazu führen, dass Menschen zu Unrecht vorteilig oder nachteilig behandelt werden. Habt ihr euch schon mal benachteiligt gefühlt? Und wenn ja, erinnert euch doch mal an die konkrete Situation. Wie war das für euch? Und was war der Grund für die Benachteiligung? Es gibt verschiedene Aspekte, die dieses Gefühl prägen können. Aufgrund von persönlichen Merkmalen wie Geschlecht, Herkunft, sozialem Status oder anderen Faktoren ungerecht behandelt zu werden oder Chancen zu verpassen, kann zu einem starken Gefühl der Benachteiligung führen. Das Empfinden, keine Kontrolle über seine eigene Situation zu haben, kann das Selbstwertgefühl beeinträchtigen und das Vertrauen in die Gesellschaft oder in soziale Strukturen erschüttern. Vielleicht haben wir auch schon mal, ob bewusst oder unbewusst, dafür gesorgt, dass ein anderer Mensch sich genauso gefühlt hat. Es ist daher wichtig, sich der eigenen Bias bewusst zu sein und aktiv Maßnahmen zu ergreifen, um sie zu erkennen und zu überwinden. Jetzt fragt ihr euch, was der Begriff Bias wieder ist. Das erklärt euch heute meine Expertin der Woche. Sie weiß, wie man einen Bias überwindet und warum dies gerade im Kontext Gesundheit so wichtig ist.
Experte der Woche.
Tessa Charlesworth ist eine experimentelle Psychologin und Assistant Professor in Management und Organization an der Northwestern University in Illinois. Sie untersucht, wie Geist und Gesellschaft im Laufe der Zeit interagieren und sich verändern. Sie hat an der Harvard University Psychologie studiert und einen Doktortitel in Psychologie erworben. Anschließend studierte sie an der Columbia University und absolvierte zusätzlich an der University of Cambridge ein weiteres Bachelorstudium in Psychologie. Die zentralen Fragen, die sie beschäftigen: Wie verändern wir unseren eigenen Geist als Reaktion auf neue Erfahrungen im Laufe des Lebens? Wie entwickelt sich die Gesellschaft als Reaktion auf neue Ereignisse, soziale Bewegungen, Wahlen, Pandemien und mehr? Ihr besonderes Interesse liegt in der Untersuchung von verschiedenen Biases und wie wir diesen entgegentreten können. Das Interview haben wir auf Englisch geführt. Tessa, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our pleasure. You describe yourself as an experimental psychologist. What is that?
Great question. So an experimental psychologist would be someone who tries to understand the mind, or more generally for me, the social world, in particular how the mind understands other people, other places, by using experiments. And that can be very broadly defined. So I do experiments actually on historical data. So I look at how attitudes have changed over the long time. But the experimental approach comes in by trying to always make sure that my inferences, what I'm inferring from the data, are causally sound. So making sure that if I say something like body weight bias is increased, for instance, I have some understanding that that's not just a quirk of my data. And so the experimental approach really is all about, how do I rule out confounds? How do I make sure that my inferences are sound?
So I got to know you when you presented on one of your favorite topics, bias. What exactly is it? And can you explain it like to a 5-year-old?
Yeah, absolutely. Bias is a very large topic these days. And the way I understand it is bias has two issues, two problems that are baked into it. One is we're biased when we deviate from the facts of the world. If you say, for instance, you know, that women are simply worse at math than men, for instance, we know based on data that that's no longer the case. Even if you look at massive standardized testing, we know that's no longer the case. So it's a deviation from fact, and therefore it's a bias. The second way you can be biased, though, is even if the facts are true, you can still be biased based on your own values. For instance, if you have a value that you want the world to be an equal place or a safe place, and yet you say something like, oh, I just think Black people commit more crimes, for instance. Actually, unfortunately, the facts are true in that case. So people might say, well, that's not a bias. But based on our values for equity and our values that we would hope that that doesn't have to be the case and that we don't want to say things like that, it's another kind of bias because it's deviating from those norms or deviating from those standards that we hold for ourselves.
And how do, you know, those biases influence the way we perceive or interpret information? What role does it play in the modern world?
They're hugely influential. So biases definitely don't just sit around in our mind. They're something that are going to shape our kind of default or automatic behaviors. So to give a couple examples, if you think about, say you're about to board a bus or a train or something, and there's a whole bunch of people on the bus and you're trying to decide where you want to sit. And there's someone who's, you know, overweight or in a larger body, and there's someone who's thinner on the other side. You may choose to just sit closer to the thinner person, even unconsciously, even just automatically, just because you have this kind of default association or default negative reaction, a bias towards someone who's fat, for instance. Other examples are, say, you're on a hiring committee, for instance, and you're hiring for math-related tasks or science-related tasks, and you have a really qualified female candidate, but also a really qualified male candidate. You might just make the default decision of like, oh yeah, the male candidate looks just that little bit more competent or that little bit more hireable, that little bit more mentorable. So you make that decision as well. And so there's tons of work now. There's these things called meta-analyses where we do studies of studies essentially and summarize all of the literature. And there's now two meta-analyses, one showing how we can predict individual behavior, so where you sit on a bus, for instance, but another one that my group is running where we're actually also predicting really large macro behavior. So things like racial disparities in preterm birth rates, for instance. We can predict racial disparities in where there are more preterm Black babies based on the average bias in those counties in the U.S. So we're able to show
again. That's amazing.
Yeah, these are fascinating studies that I can talk about. But these are more like aggregate behaviors or aggregate outcomes that we can predict also from more aggregate biases.
In which areas are the most susceptible to bias?
Yeah, oftentimes we think of the more automatic behaviors as the ones that are more susceptible to bias. So things that you do often without reflection or just sort of by gut reaction. So sitting on a bus is a great example of something that would be more predicted than maybe something that you spend a lot of time thinking about and there's a lot of accountability. So that's why hiring is actually pretty shocking that we still find bias in hiring, because that's usually a very controlled, very deliberate behavior. Often you're doing it with many people. So that we often see less of an impact of bias, but it's still there. The biggest impacts in bias are the kind of automatic behaviors that we just do every day.
My podcast is about the future of medicine and healthcare. What role does bias play in healthcare?
Many roles, as you can imagine. Any kind of behavior that we look at in healthcare, there's a susceptibility to bias, right? So this can be pain prescriptions, for instance, or prescription pain meds. We know that the default bias in the U.S. especially is that Black people, you know, have less or have more tolerance to pain and are more likely to become addicts or some other kind of stereotype. And so there's been a huge amount of literature showing that prescribers and physicians tend to underprescribe pain medication to Black people, even for the same symptoms. So again, just a plethora of examples of these really subtle behaviors that it comes into. I think a lot about these kinds of more aggregate or societal and historical factors of bias. And I think that's an especially poignant place to see for the future of medicine, especially if we think about the future of medicine being mostly driven by AI and mostly driven by big data sources. So much of these more aggregate biases that come out, you know, on aggregate in huge sets of data are just going to be replicated over and over, maybe even amplified as we increasingly rely on AI in healthcare.
So we know from, you know, historical studies that most of the studies, especially, you know, in the past 30, 40 years, were done on white male patients. And this for sure will influence AI because AI gets fed those studies and that information. So there is an implicit bias in AI, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we actually have a paper that just came out. Actually, I think the day that you and I met, it came out. But it came out about intersectional biases, actually, specifically. So the intersection of race and gender. And there you can see, for instance, if you just look at the number of words in our language that are associated with white men, it's about 59% of the traits and attributes of humans are associated with white men. 5% are associated with black women. And as you can imagine, you know, when you have that huge disparity and that underrepresentation of black women in training data, you're going to get much less accurate outputs. Black women are going to be, you know, pushed to the kinds of extremes of our algorithms and not represented accurately. So absolutely, there's a huge bias just in the kind of prevalence or the dominance of some groups in the training data of AI.
What is it that we can do to, you know, prevent biases or reduce their influence on ourselves?
Yeah, definitely the easier approach is what you mentioned second, the reducing the influence on ourselves. I think the evidence so far seems to suggest it's going to be really hard to actually change our minds and the way our minds operate. But we can add a kind of filter between our minds and our behaviors. And that's probably the most effective way to reduce. And so one of the things, for instance, in the healthcare industry that might be helpful are these kinds of just-in-time interventions. So I mentioned the pain prescribing bias. A couple hospitals have now started to include little like pop-ups when you are about to submit a prescription. And they say, you know, data from this hospital show that we tend to under-prescribe pain medication to black patients. Your patient appears to be black. Are you sure this is the right pain prescription? And it's just a kind of prompting question that allows the physician in the moment to audit their behavior and say, huh, am I biased? No, I really think this is right. You know, you don't have to change your behavior, but it's just an opportunity to interrupt that automaticity of your behavior and reflect on it one more time. So I think those kinds of filters of the just-in-time intervention seem to be the most promising.
So one of the most known biases is confirmation bias, where we seek out information that basically confirms our own opinion. What is it that we can do about it?
Definitely seek out challenging information to the extent possible. So a great way to do this is, you know, push yourself to audit your own media diets or even audit your own like friend circles and the kinds of people that you get casual information from. And if you start to notice that they're all spouting the same kind of information and it perfectly aligns with everything that you think, it might be time to try and diversify a little bit of your media diet or a little bit of your friendship network. And it doesn't have to be like, you don't have to make a new best friend who's from the opposite political party or who has a completely different set of ideologies. That's very unlikely to happen. But it's just exposing yourselves to alternatives, because that will help you recognize where confirmation bias could be coming into play and where alternatives could be helpful.
We have a bi-weekly newsletter. It's called MedTech Pulse, and we recently addressed medical misinformation, which has dramatically increased, especially during times of COVID, due to the use of social networks.
Yeah.
And confirmation bias and how the algorithms work out is actually you consume a piece of content and then the algorithm learns that, you know, to give you more similar pieces of those contents.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And actually my colleague here at Kellogg, his name's Billy Brady, he studies these kinds of algorithms and the specific kind of content that they amplify. And yes, it's anything from your in-group, so anything from people who are like you, but it's also these kinds of extreme moralized content that's like way more extreme and way more, you know, negative generally than the average content on those media. Those get amplified. And so you start to imagine that that's the state of the world.
is one way to counteract, to look for an opposite opinion or, you know, piece of content and to consume that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you think of what's being amplified, like your in-group, negative content, moralized content, a great way is to say, knowing that that's the data of what I'm exposed to or what my default media diet might be. It's like, could I find some positive content? Could I actually go out? And it honestly, just to recalibrate yourself, it could even just be, could I find some positive content like cat videos or dog videos or something like that? Because it helps recalibrate and make you understand, oh, the state of the world is not all doom and gloom. And it helps you get out of this kind of spiral of these amplified media contents. And definitely a huge thing to do is to try and look outside your echo chamber or look outside your kind of bubble of media content. And so that could be following someone who's more moderate rather than someone who's more extreme, maybe following, you know, more national news sources rather than politicized news sources, which is quite common on social media. And then also often you can try and seek out like primary sources. This is a little bit of like an academics inference or error suggestion, but I often, especially with like medical news or with news about the state of the world, you know, in terms of wars or something like that, like go out and actually seek the researchers who are doing that work, because you might be getting a more balanced take on the actual data.
Yeah, we briefly touched racial biases. Let's talk about gender biases. How can gender bias affect patient care, in your opinion?
Yeah.
What does your studies show?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's actually two big stories with gender bias. So one, you already mentioned that the kind of data or the default assumptions that previous treatment plans were based on, you know, what to recognize with stroke symptoms, what to recognize with heart attack symptoms, those kinds of things are all based on like the default male patient. So that's a huge advantage that's coming now as we start to recognize the need for diverse samples and increasing our samples about women and kind of recalibrating the inferences we make. The other thing in healthcare, though, that I want to mention is like the historical dominance of men as physicians and the hope for change that I have there. Because we now see, you know, in many med schools, for instance, it's like 50-50. Some med schools are even more females than males or incoming students. And so there's a possibility that, again, because of the way implicit bias especially operates, we may not even be aware of all the ways that gender bias has been dominating in medicine until we have, you know, a 60% or even 50-50% female physician workforce. And they can point out things like, oh, hey, you know, the robes are kind of designed in an interesting way. Or have we thought about, you know, redesigning the bathrooms in this way or something like that, with all these baked in assumptions that we might not have noticed until we have a diverse workforce.
How can medical training programs raise awareness of bias among aspiring doctors and nurses, and how can they be trained?
It's a great question, and it's one that's actually really fraught in my area of research. Because one of the risks I'll mention right off the bat is when we train people, doctors, but also police officers, you know, even construction workers, whoever, about implicit bias, there's a risk that they interpret that data to suggest, well, everyone's biased, it's automatic, there's nothing I can do about it. And there's actually been some work showing that when you give people our kind of default implicit bias training, just teaching them about implicit bias, they actually are less willing to intervene on their behaviors, less willing to put up filters, because they kind of say, well, I'm not responsible for these massive societal biases and these things that are implicit and automatic. And so I think we really have to be mindful of walking this tightrope of, yes, we need to raise awareness about the bias, but it always needs to be paired with like concrete ways that that bias is showing up in your behaviors, so that we make sure that people feel accountable and that we make sure that people also feel empowered to understand the ways that they can actually change as well. So the small examples I gave of like, you know, the little pop-ups, for instance, of like, oh, that's a really clear, concrete example, not just if there's implicit bias in the world, but this is how it's shown up. And then the empowered component is to make sure that people know, oh, okay, the thing I'm supposed to do now is to challenge my assumptions or to make sure that I check whether, you know, the symptoms really match up with my prescription, regardless of race, for instance. And so always kind of, I think of those as like the three steps of like awareness, accountability, and then empowerment to actually make change as well.
And how can researchers like you and policymakers help direct public attention to bias in healthcare and promote effective measures to combat it?
I'm still learning how to do that exactly. As you know well, there is a kind of, talk about filters, there's a big filter between the ivory tower of academia and policymakers and practitioners. So I think there is a better pipeline now between research to practice, and especially in the area of bias. I think, you know, 2020 and the murder of George Floyd and all of the protests really raised public awareness about bias more generally. And so I think policymakers are looking for our research now and aware of our research. But I think on our end, as researchers, there's more for us to do to really clearly describe what we do and really clearly describe those kinds of second two steps that I mentioned in the intervention of the accountability and the empowerment. Because so often we just point to a problem, we say there's a big problem in society, but we don't actually do the research on, you know, how to make people accountable and how to empower people to actually make change. So my hope is, you know, there are initiatives. Actually, another colleague, Trish Devine at the University of Wisconsin, has these large training programs that she runs about implicit bias that have those kinds of three components. And she does them mostly for other academics. But I think there's a huge potential for implementing those in healthcare industries. Again, I mentioned policing. We know that's a big problem as well. So I think, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we're becoming more translational scientists.
Tessa, thank you very much for your time and this very interesting conversation. Thank you for making the world a better place by raising awareness for bias in society. It's a society, you know, it's a big problem for society and all over the world. So your research and work is very helpful in that sense. So thank you very much.
I'm so honored. Thank you so much.
Die Fakten der Folge.
Bias oder Voreingenommenheit wird als Abweichung von Fakten oder eigenen Werten definiert. Es kann entweder von der Realität abweichen oder sogar im Einklang mit Fakten stehen, aber dennoch gegen persönliche Werte verstoßen. Voreingenommenheit spielt eine bedeutende Rolle in verschiedenen Bereichen, insbesondere im Gesundheitswesen. Sie kann sich auf die Art und Weise auswirken, wie Patienten behandelt werden, von der Verschreibung von Medikamenten bis zur Diagnose von Symptomen. Wir haben gehört, dass Bewusstsein und Intervention notwendig sind, um den Einfluss von Voreingenommenheit zu reduzieren. Dies kann durch Schulungen, Eingriffe in Echtzeit und die Förderung von Vielfalt und Gleichberechtigung erreicht werden. Forscher und Politiker können dazu beitragen, die öffentliche Aufmerksamkeit auf Bias im Gesundheitswesen zu lenken und wirksame Maßnahmen zur Bekämpfung zu fördern, indem sie Transparenz schaffen, Interventionen entwickeln und die Zusammenarbeit zwischen verschiedenen Akteuren fördern. Eine weitere Folge von Mission Gesundheit neigt sich dem Ende. Bevor ich mich verabschiede, möchte ich euch noch etwas auf den Weg geben. Egal, ob es um unsere Gesundheit geht oder um andere Bereiche des Lebens, denkt daran, dass eure Stimme wichtig ist. Stellt Fragen, sucht nach Antworten und nehmt aktiv an unserer eigenen Gesundheitsversorgung teil. Lasst uns auch weiterhin diese Reise durch die faszinierende Welt der Medizin gemeinsam gehen. Schreibt uns dafür wie immer gerne an podcast@ceramtech.de.
Hardys Random Reminder.
Random Reminder: mit mehr Plan gesünder essen. Eine gesunde Ernährung stellt für viele eine Herausforderung dar, dass sie oft wenig Zeit haben, um ausgewogene Mahlzeiten zuzubereiten, schlechte Essgewohnheiten schwer abzulegen sind und der Zugang zu gesunden Lebensmitteln eingeschränkt sein kann. Was wir zu uns nehmen, ist aber entscheidend für die Erhaltung und Förderung der eigenen Gesundheit. Es gibt aber ein paar einfache Tricks, um eine gesunde Ernährung im Alltag zu implementieren. Ein wichtiger Schritt besteht darin, die Impulskontrolle zu stärken. Klingt kompliziert, ist aber ganz einfach. Dazu gehören nämlich auch schon das Schreiben einer Einkaufsliste, Einkaufen ohne Hunger und interessanterweise auch die Barzahlung im Supermarkt, was laut einer Studie des Journal of Consumer Research zu bewusstem Einkaufen und einer höheren Wahrscheinlichkeit führt, gesunde und kalorienarme Lebensmittel zu wählen. Bewusst essen beginnt also schon im Supermarkt. Mein Random Reminder in dieser Woche daher: lieber mehr planen, anstatt mehr zu essen. Bis zum nächsten Mal, bleibt gesund und neugierig.
Das war Mission Gesundheit. Am Puls des medizinischen Fortschritts mit Dr. Hadi Saleh. Eine Produktion von Ceramtech, einer der weltweit führenden Medizintechnik-Plattformen. Sie haben eine Frage an Dr. Hadi Saleh? Schreiben Sie uns an podcast@ceramtech.de.